Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, all. Charlie Hedges here. Welcome you to the next chapter with Charlie. Boy, are we in for a treat today. I am not at all overstating it when I say that my guest today, health and wellness coach Courtney Marcassani, is not only brilliant and provocative, but she also offers very practical wisdom that will impact all our lives. Courtney is the author of a most stimulating book titled Four Gifts of the Highly Sensitive. Her insights into sensitivity will help you identify your gifts of intuition, empathy, vision, and expression. Her keen ideas will most certainly help you maximize your potential. Learning about sensitivity's silent effects will impact your mental, emotional, and spiritual health. Now, although in our culture the idea of sensitivity typically comes with all sorts of negative baggage, in this show, Courtney and I explore how being a gifted sensitive will bring a whole new perspective on life. With that, let's bring on my new friend, Courtney Marcassani. Courtney Marcassani, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Hi, Charlie. Thanks for having me. This is the best day of my life.
So you did it. Just so the audience know, I prompted her to say that. I had no idea she was going to say that. That's good. So we'll find out how good of a day
it's
your best day is.
It really is the best day of my life.
That's great. Well, we talked about that, didn't we? That I had a question. I think we talked about it. I had a question that I have this little journaling thing that I do for my son, and I'm provided with questions. And one of the questions was, tell us a time when was the happiest day of your life or the happiest time of your life. And my response was, now. How could it be anything else? If it's anything else, it's very sad that now has to be the best time of my life because it's the consummation of everything I've done thus far. Would you agree?
Yeah, you're the sum of everything you've ever lived right now.
Yeah, and you know, some would say like it or not, but as you so aptly mentioned when we talked before about the fortune of misfortune and that the misfortune, those, we'll talk about this in the podcast, but those are great times of learning, aren't they? Those are the times that we do our most growth, is
yes,
times of...
Yes, and it's also times when you experience, many times pain or unexpected suffering, and you are able to be tempered in a way and come out stronger. It's another way of looking at it.
Absolutely. You know, it's that old a metaphor of a weld and a broken bone, is that I learned this when I took welding class, I think, in high school, and they said the weld, if you do the weld well, it is actually stronger than the iron was previous to the weld. And I have heard that's about broken bones, too. Once a bone is broken, it's actually stronger in the broken part. Is that true? Do you know? You've got a bit of medical background.
Are you phrasing that to me?
Yes, I was phrasing that to you.
Well, I was thinking about the heart. I immediately started seeing the heart when you were talking about the bones and the welding. And so then I kind of took a leap there, a quantum leap to the heart, you know, and I saw the heart healing over. You know, when we get our hearts broken, it feels like the end of everything.
Yeah.
But it does come back and it heals and it seems to apply to the heart as well, heart medicine.
You know, there's a wonderful discipline in Japanese culture called kintsugi, I believe it is. And it's when you've seen these broken cups or broken pots, and they are mended with gold, with gold laced epoxy, and so there's gold lines running through them that shows they were once broken. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I have learned a little bit about Japanese art and Japanese functional art, and of course, the famous story about the Japanese potter who, you know, the emperor loved his work. He did art for the wealthy caste, but other individuals wanted his art as well, and so that he would have mistakes And then, you know, he would fix the mistakes and then put the cast-offs in, and he would mark them in a certain way. So I thought that was another beautiful story,
yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily encapture all that you're trying to say about the broken pieces and putting them back together. So that part of it, I'm not exactly sure. I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, what it is highlighting the broken, and that the broken is such a strong part, an important part of life, that it's highlighting the broken. It's part of a discipline known as wabi-sabi, which is calls for things are imperfect, impermanent, and one other M.
It's, yeah, I have heard of wabi-sabi, and I am familiar with that.
Yeah, so
concept.
So we divert from our subject of the four gifts of the highly sensitive, and we just start talking about life, the universe, and everything. I am so glad that my colleague discovered you and your new book, Four Gifts of Highly Sensitive, and I think today's show really might serve up new morsels of thought for us to what I'm saying, chew on for a while, keeping within the metaphor. And I am curious, since you take on such a mystical and misunderstood way of thinking, I'm wondering, before we even get started, do we need to get into a definition of terms and of the sensitive? But before we do that, I see another question. Before we do that, I want to get into the definition of what you call the sensitive, mm-hmm. how you define it. But even before you define it, I wonder, in the process of you focusing on the positive aspects of the sensitive person, I wonder what kind of feedback have you received in that, Courtney? Do you experience more agreement or more pushback?
Well, I think it depends on the timeline of my journey. I mean, in the beginning, I was in a very traditional environment in psychology and psychiatry, where I started to talk about what would be called anomalous experiences, or you know, basically things that happen with perception that are outside the normal range, with my colleagues. And I definitely got pushback. That was about 20 years ago when I started really researching and digging into the topic. But nowadays, I find that people are more curious and interested about it. And I also find that people who have found the book and have read it are very excited about it, because they feel like it describes them in a way that they've never been described before. And there's a relief, a palpable relief. So it runs the gamut. Depends.
Well, you know, a couple thoughts. The book is very well written. You really are a good writer. And
thank you.
And it's obvious you've done a lot of writing. Also, my other thought was, the people that are attracted to this thought and you know, and sort of have personal experience with it, we haven't even defined sensitive, so I'm kind of ahead of myself here. But I do want to ask, what is the percentage of the population? I think I read that you had, was it like 15-20% of the population is highly sensitive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 15-20%. So one in four, one in five people. You know, one in four would be, of course, 25%. So around one in four, one in five. Yeah. That's the percentage of the population that has, you know, which generally called sensitivity, but it's also, you know, technically called sensory processing sensitivity. That's the clinical aspect of it.
Oh, that's actually helpful. That's a helpful definition.
Yeah, well, it's a mouthful. You know, sensory processing sensitivity is what you're asking me to define, I think, and that is the organic brain function of individuals who are, you know, more, just as we know them as sensitives. They have this depth perception in their sensory processing. So that's sight, sound, taste, touch, smell. Those are the five classical senses, but there's also interoception, which is your internal awareness of bodily physical states. Then there's neuroception, and then there's proprioception, there's the vestibular system. I mean, so I quantify all of those in the book and go into each of those systems. But then essentially people who have sensory processing sensitivity are able to see, hear, and feel more sensory information coming into their five senses. But then they also have a faster emotional reactivity to what they feel, what they see, hear, and feel. So they feel emotional quicker. And it feels like sometimes very overwhelming, depending on the environment. That's the short version.
Yeah, well, it's quite complete. The sensitive, in your definition, you come from a fresh lens in normal speech of sensitive, because the sensitive person, you know, when you say sensitive, it really is fraught. That term is fraught with negative baggage, isn't it? Like you're either crazy or delusional or sensitive. Oh, he's so sensitive. Yeah. You know, you can't say anything around him. He's going to get all bummed and all. You know, that's the way we take sensitive. But you have an entirely different concept of what the sensitive person is, and that's a truly a highly gifted person. Would you not say?
Yes, definitely highly gifted. I mean, I think that because you see the a lot of the sensitivity research that really backs the science of it, the first highly sensitive person scale that was developed by Dr. Aaron has been studied and verified and has been shown to be reliable by 4- and 5-factor analysis and cross-culturally as well around the globe. And so it's, you know, it's valid. It's a valid measurement of sensitivity. And so once that was established in the late 90s, it's been catching more and more. But my take on it is essentially, out of all those individuals, that 20%, if you start to really look into that 20%, you find these patterns emerge, and they're also part of the personality. I mean, they're personality traits, but they're also the way an individual's sensory perception has helped them develop talents, I would say, that it would be a learning and development where they had things strengthened through their sensory perception, and then they developed it further. And that's what became the four gifts. I noticed those patterns that individuals who are sensitive kind of developed over the course of their life. And so I articulated what I saw in those patterns, and that became the four gifts.
You know, you have on your website the Inspired Potential. What is it?
Inspired Potentials. Yeah.
Inspired Potential, and you have a sensitivity test or exercise or assessment tool.
I call it the sensitive gifts test. So it's a way of teasing out what your gift is, and you can go through the 40 questions. It is somewhat long, but it's designed that way to try to tease out what the gift is. And sometimes there's overlapping, like intuitive empath or intuitive visionary. And so if they overlap, then I explain for the folks who are doing those, you know, what that means for them.
Yeah, and that was where mine was, wasn't it?
It's uncannily, you know, accurate, and they feel it's usually right on.
Well, you know, one thing it did for me is it helped, like you said, it helped define some of my, not define, but helped me understand some of my personality traits and some of my actions that I had never thought of in terms of a sensitive or in a sort of gift in a different way. I just, you know, thinking that's the way I'm hardwired, which it is the way I'm hardwired, but I hadn't fully investigated that hardwiring.
Well, that's kind of how I came at it too, to be honest, Charlie. I kind of back engineered, you know, I had read Dr. Aaron's book because I was, you know, I was getting my psychology degree, my bachelor's at the University of Montana when I first saw her book for the first time, and I read it. And, you know, I read it and I thought it made a lot of sense, but it didn't make like a huge impression on me to where I looked at it and said, oh, I'm one of these people. I just didn't identify with it at the time. And maybe that was because I was too young. I don't know. But then when I started to have these phenomenon happen in my life over years and years, I mean, I still didn't even touch sensitivity after I read that book in my 20s. I just kept plowing forward trying to understand the anomalous aspects. So it was literally 20 years later, when I had an intuitive insight, I was doing some deep personal work, transformative work, and I had a dream that really kind of guided me into, this is what it is. You know, it's sensitivity. And then I took I kind of recast all my own personal experiences in a new light and my research too. And that's where my bell inside was rung. It was like the big ding. And then it reverberated. And so at that point, I went, oh my gosh, this is all related. The research, the personal experiences, the medical side of it. And that's when the book came, The Four Gifts.
Thought occurred to me that the dream that you had, that is one part of a gift of the sensitive, is it not? That sensitives are especially sensitive to dreams and visions, mm-hmm. and intuitions. Is that not part of a sensitive?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole spectrum of experiences that I look at and kind of label as being hypersensitive or being on an extreme. That's where a lot of the gifts happen, you know, that aren't typical or normal for a lot of people, that you definitely see having more often and more vivid, more intense. Sometimes it's prophetic. So yes, definitely.
You know, I would think of the people that I'm reading now. I think I told you I'm reading, and most of my audience knows, I'm doing a deep dive into late medieval Christian mysticism, so from like late 1200s to the late 1400s. And so many of these Christian mystics were what you define as sensitive. They they had...
My grandma would say, and how?
Would she? Yeah, you know, they had visions. They had visions of the Christ and intimacies, and, you know, mm-hmm. Teresa of Avila, you know, had several visions, and as did Julian of Norwich, and those really drove, you know, two of probably the most influential mystics. Well, there's several influential mystics, but Teresa and Julian are very strong at that. You know, I'm debating where I want to go next. I want to go into the sensitive, but you know what I think is important, Courtney? Let's do a bit of explaining your credentials and your credibility, not that you're uncredible, but, you know, how credible you are as a therapist and a wellness coach and a sensitive. Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, I know you've worked in centers and all sorts of places for a number of years that have given you quite a breadth of experience in this. Can you kind of highlight that a little bit for me?
Sure. I mean, I think the beginning of it was, you know, psychology. I went into psychology, and I didn't know that that was going to be where I was going to land. I was initially interested in maybe like, you know, law when I was coming out of high school. But I went to a local college here in Pennsylvania where I was born and raised, and I didn't study for the test or I didn't study for the you know, basically like the quiz our professor was going to give us in class. And so I showed up and I knew the answers. And I remember him pulling me out of class and saying, you know, I want you to stop by my office. And I was worried, you know, because I hadn't studied for class. And I felt anxiety. And he said, Courtney, I have you ever thought about psychology? And I hadn't. I really hadn't. And so I said, no. And he said, I think you have a career. And I said, well, thank you, you know, Dr. Longinus. I'll think about it. And, you know, he saw something in me, and that was the beginning of my journey into psychology. And so I got my bachelor's at the University of Montana, and I really did love psychology and all the different sides of it. And then I moved after I got my degree and went to Seattle. It was during the dot-com era, and I ended up working in mental health from, you know, the time I graduated, for about 10 years. And my star was kind of rising in Seattle, Washington, because I was working in housing and homelessness, and I was lobbying for national grants to be used in King County. And I won some awards in King County for my housing advocacy Because I worked with a difficult population. I mean, they were called folks who had chronic mental illness, and so I was a clinical provider. I worked with people one-on-one, and I essentially helped them transition from the streets, you know, back into our communities in Seattle. And so I was really good at that. And I think at one point there, I started to see the cyclical nature of, you know, the just the crisis of, you know, the ER system, and, you know, we called it the revolving door,
mm-hmm.
because folks who would go and get mental health treatment just kind of continued to cycle through that system. And so I kind of got burnt out, and I also didn't realize at the time that I might have had some compassion fatigue as a provider. But at that same time, when I was in the field of mental health, that's when I started to have some pretty profound experiences in my own personal life. I think I had told you about the dreams, but I also had stopped a fire in a three-story brownstone. I mean, I didn't literally stop a fire, but I sensed the fire before it happened, and I was able to get back and intervene. A friend of mine showed back up at the apartment, and she had left a candle burning, essentially, and we got there in time, in the nick of time. And so I started at that point to investigate what that was, what that experience was. And, you know, because of the extreme nature of it, I knew that there was a reason why that was happening and why I was picking up on danger. And so from that point, which was in the early 2000s, I started to research on the side in my, you know, in my free time, you know, why are these anomalies happening? So over time, I guess I stepped away from psychology and mental health and acute crisis mental health and explored other pursuits and passions like writing and, you know, business and entrepreneurial stuff. And then I came back to health because I figured that health needed to be more creative and more empowering. And then I got my integrative medicine degree. So it's like a holistic medicine. And that's what I do now. So I teach, I educate, I'm a coach. I worked recently in a corporate wellness center doing corporate wellness, you know, in the city of Anchorage. And so I'm still in wellness. I guess I have a new voice about it now. And I believe that health should include mind, body, and spirit. That would be my history and my work.
Oh, that's
up
wonderful.
Until now.
So let's do this for the layperson. And okay. we spoke in real technical terms.
Uh-huh.
Now let's dumb it down for me. And how would you, in just a few sentences, describe what it means to be a sensitive and not to be sensitive in the negative sense, but to be a sensitive in the positive sense? What does that mean to be a sensitive, you know, in everyday language?
Well, the beautiful part of being sensitive is that you connect with beauty and the depth of beauty and colors and textures and feeling. The depth of feeling is almost so overwhelming at times it can be. And so when you're connecting with your environment in a way that is tranquil or beautiful or connecting with animals or other people that you dearly love, and you're feeling that deep loving connection, it just feels blissful. And so because you're sensitive, you're going to feel states of the magnificence of nature and the sun and the moon and, you know, all the cycles of things more profoundly. You're also going to be able to connect with others in a way that feels almost telepathic. Or you'll be able to translate emotions in a way with clarity that just really rings so true for the other individual that you're connecting with. That's another profound positive thing. You know, a lot of times creativity, I mean, that's the other beautiful part of it, especially for the aesthetic senses. You become very highly creative, and you can just synthesize all that beauty, that profound beauty that you feel through your art, whether that's writing or dancing and movement, or it's creating movies and pictures, or you're an editor. I mean, it flows so seamlessly into the creative arts that sensitivity is a real asset there.
You know, this is interesting. I feel like you're reading my tea leaves. And I've heard this for the first time, and yet everything you're saying, I'm going, oh my goodness, I identify. And
good. I'm so glad. It usually means that it's right on the money, you know, when you can, it has that ring of truth to it.
We talked briefly. This does have something to do with the integration of hemispheric brain thought, doesn't it?
Has something to do with the integration with what? I didn't catch that.
Hemispheric brain thought, left and right brain thinking.
Oh, definitely synchronization of right and left hemispheric brain. Yes, yes.
So we live in a Newtonian left brain, age of reason, age of enlightenment culture.
Absolutely.
That is in the process.
No doubt about
though,
that.
I think, Courtney, don't you think we're in the process of, you know, I'm not going to say it's a wholesale movement over there, but much more acceptance to the right brain. And
yes,
to,
I do think the pendulum's swinging back. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's very important, because that's not so much logic and facts and figures as it is intuition, perception, heart, values. Gosh, you know, I could go on with a list, but...
Well, we've always been here. We have always been here. I mean, that's the thing about the evolutionary theory about sensitivity. They call it biological context. This is sensitive survival strategy, that we are evolutionarily part of humanity evolving because sensitives are more able to be aware of whatever you want to use as your term, challenge or threat or survival. It's a survival instinct. And not only is it an instinct, but it's the way that our natural selection has worked over this time that we've evolved, that sensitives must be part of the community. And so it's not that we haven't been here. It's that because we've been so far over to the left in
right.
the reason logic paradigm, that we've just been kind of left out, you know, along the way. But we're still here, and we have been charging forward with movements for compassion and enlightenment and equal rights and movements. I mean, sensitives are part of that. But we just haven't been really considered. And so I do think that the pendulum is swinging back because we've been living in that other extreme for so long, it has to come back towards the middle.
Think of our educational system. How are we taught to learn? We are not taught to think. Sort of gestalt, wide open thinking, where it's very narrow-minded, one answer to the test.
It goes back to Socrates. I mean, it's been that long. I mean, Socrates, Aristotle, Descartes, I mean, it's one era after another. It's been so long since we've been part of this. And so I do think that education's going to have to change more. I think that human rights is definitely going to change more. I mean, it's slow. It's slow because we're talking about big bureaucratic systems and overlapping systems. But I do believe that it is, we're at a catalyst now, especially with the pandemic, where people want to live for their quality of life. And that's going to shift things as well, more to the right hemispheric, as we feel more and want to be connected to our families more and to not be grinding away at work and feeling that loss of quality of life that's so very important for balance between the left and the right, or the analytic and the feeling states.
Do you think the right brain is, you know, sort of the Chinese yin and yang? I'm not talking gender as much, but type. Do you think it's more the feminine side and the left brain is more the masculine
it's
side?
It's definitely receptive. So, you know, with the yin and the yang, it's the light side is, you know, there's the receptive side, and it goes through the list of the different qualities. But I do believe definitely the right side is more receptive, more holistic, more wide open in terms of the way that... the brain and the right side receives images from the world. It's like Jill Bolte-Taylor described after she had her stroke, And she was, it was all right hemispheric, and she could feel the emotions of the nurses who were coming into her room to treat her, and she could feel all these holistic images coming in. And so, yes, I definitely think the right is all about, it's about face. It's about the recognition of faces and emotions and feelings and images. It's the left that, you know, does the judging. All the judging. And so it's analytic. It also uses language, but in a different way. And it's also very, very heavily reliant upon judging and analyzing the situation. And the right's the feeler. So yeah, I would say that. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
You know, Ilya Delio, who is a sort of an evolutionary mystic. She talks, and she's brilliant, by the way. She's a Franciscan.
Okay, I have to write that name down.
I-L-L-I-A, and then it's D-E-L-H-I-O, Ilya Delio. She's a mystic who studied Bonaventure a lot, and she's also very strongly an advocate of evolution, but not, we always, when we talk evolution, we're always thinking Darwinian evolution, and Darwinian evolution is just one subset of evolution. You know, it does not summarize the totality of evolution. Evolution is much grander.
That whole debate about how, you know, humans evolved, and a lot of people believe that we evolved from apes, and that's not true. I mean, there's a lot of sweeping generalizations that people, you know, kind of construe. I mean, we had a common ancestor. You know, with the chimpanzees, and then from that common ancestor, those two branches split off, right? And so we have like this old world cousin, you know, but then there was natural selection between other hominids. And so it's interesting because we have these general ideas and they're false, you know, and then most recent evolutionary, you know, biological research has shown, because a lot of people didn't think that apes could, you know, learn certain self-referencing language or have the theory of mind, is what they call it, is we have a mind. You know, humans have a mind where we can self-reference, we can predict, we can ask, how do you feel today? Whereas there was a lot of lore in the, you know, biology community that language was the one thing that set us apart. And that one profound researcher, Sue Rimbach, she found that apes could learn language similar to humans if the baby apes learned like human infants learn language. And so that's one of the breakthroughs that have come through. And so, you know, even natural selection and all this has a bunch of biases and misunderstandings and things being misconstrued within it that we generalize about, and it's still not true. And so it's interesting when you say evolutionary, you know, biology or natural selection, you know, it's interesting the way people pull information out of that field and then just make a thought belief out of it, and it's not necessarily correct.
Yeah, and it's so much more complex than
it is.
You know,
I mean,
if you
look at the past, even people like Noam Chomsky, who did language, you know, and heuristics, and he did his whole universe of grammar. You know, he thought as well that, you know, we were separate from animals because of that distinguishable language that we have. And so when I read recently that one researcher with the bonobos was able to find out that their babies could learn language like humans, I thought, well, that's interesting, isn't it?
It's fascinating. That's extraordinarily fascinating. I mean,
it makes you think about empathy in different ways. It makes you think about the way we connect with animals and how we communicate with them, and how empaths, deep empaths, seem to be able to communicate with their animals through an empathic, telepathic almost connection, and then the animal communicators, you know, it makes you rethink that in terms of language. And so there's just a lot of misconceptions about sensitivity, and, you know, and I look at it pretty carefully because I'm always looking for the way that it exists and makes us, you know, connect and in ways that are more profound, like you were talking about, the benefits, the positives of it.
Yeah, you're a highly sensitive person, and I want to I want to explore that.
There's no doubt about that.
That's what we're going to do after the break. We're going to explore that. But I did have a question.
Okay.
And my question is, of the 20%, say, of sensitive people in our culture,
mm-hmm.
how many either don't know they're a sensitive or they're ashamed of being a sensitive because they get mocked called crazy or delusional? I imagine a lot of people just give up on it and don't pay attention to their gifts. Is my imagination correct?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people don't know they're sensitive. They don't realize.
Or don't want to admit it.
I don't have a number to give you. And then I do think you're right that it falls along certain lines that even if they know or have an inkling that they might be sensitive, especially if their environment was somewhat non-accepting, there is more likelihood that they will not self-identify because those individuals are much more adaptive into the environment to become what is needed or what they feel is appropriate, because sensitivity is basically an evolutionary adaptation trait, I mean, how we adapt. And so you see that come to full fruition when individuals would much rather pretend to be somebody else than be themselves.
Well, they want to be a part of the tribe.
That's a very real phenomenon.
You know, they want to be a part of the tribe. They want to be accepted.
Yeah,
and
we all do.
That's the way you play. Okay, what we're going to do is take a break.
Okay.
And when we return, we are going to do a bit of focusing on you. Are you ready for that?
I'm never ready for that, but I'll be courageous.
Okay, let's take a quick break. Hi there, you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and I'm Charlie Hedges, and my very special guest today is Courtney Marcassani, and she is the author to a book titled The Four Gifts of the Highly Sensitive, and this is talking about gifted people. This is not talking about sensitive in our negative language, that they're so sensitive you can't talk to them because they're so filled with drama. This is not about drama, and this is not about overreacting to situations. This is talking about a specially gifted individual. And our guest today, Courtney, is a specially gifted person. So, Courtney, what I want to talk about is, when did you first become aware of the truth that your thought processes were a bit different from the Newtonian left-brain traditional thought?
Wow. That's such a good question. I mean, I can look back and look at experiences as my own guide and signpost. My dreams were the most remarkable thing that stood out to me, because the dreams seemed to inform me in a way that they weren't informing others around me. I mean, that's very simplistic, but they were prophetic at times. And sometimes, I mean, I think the first time it ever happened, the dream that I had was played out almost exactly. I mean, the one section of it, the tail end section of the dream, played out as I exactly saw it in my dream. And so that happened when I was in my 20s, my early 20s.
Oh, so you were in your 20s before you, this was not a childhood revelation.
No. I mean, I think I was, obviously, when I was
Of course
child,
you were, but you didn't
it
recognize it.
It wasn't reinforced. It wasn't identified. I mean, I was one of those people that you were asking about who had to adapt. So I became highly, highly adaptable. And I think the reason why I became highly adaptable is because I was probably pretty far out on that extreme of sensitivity, where I was just constantly sensing what I needed to be in my environment, and then I became that.
We have another 20 minutes or so, but
okay.
But give me in for no more than 5 minutes. Can you tell me a story of one of your experiences that led you to say, there's something going on here.
Yeah, well, one of the turning points, I would say, and you and I did not talk about this in our call, but one of the turning points for me, because I had seen the dreams, I knew that they were prophetic sometimes, or precognitive was how I called them at the time, precognitive. I didn't have that language of prophetic, which comes more from the, you know, the Christian biblical sense. I did have a remarkable experience that kind of, it just set it apart from all the others. And I had been married, but then we got separated and eventually divorced. And my ex-husband's grandma, she had passed away back in Montana, but of course we were living in Seattle at the time with our daughter. And, you know, I was just not, I didn't have a lot of money. I was a single mom, and so I couldn't make the trip back to Montana to see her, you know, and say goodbye or, you know, go to the memorial service or be with the family. But, you know, he said, yeah, well, you're welcome to come. My family would love for you to come, you know, even though we were divorced. They weren't going to treat me any different. And so I was invited to come to the funeral, but I couldn't go. I couldn't attend. And so I knew when the service was, and I sent flowers because I couldn't make it, couldn't afford to go. And I went and had a dream that night. And in the dream, I saw her. I saw Grandma Donna. And she looked young. Now, there was this whole odyssey before I got to where she was, which was also pretty remarkable, the way the dream was cast. It was like following a little adventure. But then as I passed through the adventure part of it, she arrived. And she looked young. She had young color hair, you know, not the gray as I knew it when I knew her. And I said, Grandma Donna, you know, you're here. And she said, yes. And I said, how can you be here? You know, and she looked at me and she didn't say anything. And I said, well, you're dead. And she said, well, they let us have a moment of goodbye. This is the goodbye moment. And so I looked at her, and then she asked me if I knew that she was a nurse. Did you know I was a nurse? And I said, no, I didn't know. And so from there, she kind of dematerialized in the dream, I guess would be the best way to put it. And a friend of mine, her name was June. June was a very special person to me, kind of like my first spiritual teacher. Mm-hmm. She said, Courtney, your uncle is here. Now, my uncle passed away 15 years earlier at this point, and I was so excited, you know, because he was my favorite relative.
And this is in your dream.
And she said, he's here, he's going to touch the back of your neck. And sure enough, in the dream, I felt this whoosh, like a big whoosh of wind and a hand, like a hand going up the back of my neck. And I yelled out. In the dream, I yelled out because I was surprised. You know, it was not expected. And sure enough, I heard his words, and he had a message, and then I woke up. And so I wrote everything down, and I just cried. I cried. That was the first thing I did. I just wept because I missed, you know, my uncle. It had been so long. He had died under, you know, very traumatic circumstances. And so I cried because I heard his voice. And then I traced everything and wrote everything down about Grandma Donna. But that was the singular moment that I went, oh, my God. I just communicated with people in the afterlife. And I didn't think that was possible. I was an atheist. I was an atheist up until that point. I really felt like the here and now was all we had.
Yes.
And there was no beyond. That was a turning point for me. And I knew I was different at that point, that there was something within me inherently that allowed that experience to happen through a dream.
And it's just become more and more common since that time. You've been able to recognize it and identify it better. Is that it?
Oh, definitely. And I think that I was kicked into gear at that point to change belief systems. And I was still working at Harborview Medical Center, you know, at the trauma center at that time. And so I started to meditate more frequently, where I would just sit down and close down my perception and go inward. And because my job was so complex and so difficult, and there were so many layers to it that I had to navigate at that trauma center, I would sit in my office too in the middle of the day, and I would just take a break. So I think the meditation also allowed that perceptive awareness to expand, but there's no doubt that it expanded. I do think that because of my divorce and because I was a single mom and I was focusing more on myself and kind of collecting myself and figuring out who I was, I just didn't know that that's who I was, that I was this person that could perceive so, I don't know, such an expansive type of perception. I had no idea. And so when the Grandma Donna dream came, I started to seek out help. I mean, I contacted Sister Mary Claire. She was a relative of Grandma Donna, and she was in Minnesota, and I sent her letters saying that I had saw Donna and that she communicated with me. And so Sister Mary Claire was the first person that accepted it. Whereas the other individuals in the family, I think they thought I was crazy or I was making stuff up, you know, whereas Sister Mary Claire, you know, she took me seriously. And so we wrote a couple letters back and forth. And then June, I spoke with June about it. And June had had a couple of near-death experiences. And she's somebody who I felt safe with to share what was going on. And especially since she was in the dream, she broke it down. Oh, well, this is what happened, and this is how we communicated. And she became kind of a teacher to me for a while to help explain those experiences so that my psyche wasn't jarred. But I had no idea I had that kind of insight or expansive perception. And it did grow, and it did go much further beyond over the years.
Fascinating. What does the left brain thinker and the person who has difficulty believing in
the skeptics,
you know, and they have difficulty believing in, you know, I don't want to call it abnormal. It's just, It's not usual, but it can't be abnormal if it's normal to human beings. It's just that we're having a difficult time normalizing it within ourselves and accepting it.
Well,
that doesn't make it abnormal.
I mean, there's been a historical division between these two fields for a long time. I mean, you can see the funding for the arts going away. You can see more money being dumped into science for hard science. And one of the reasons why I think things are going to swing back around, I mean, I don't think they're going to come full circle like they were, you know, before the Socrates time, but I do believe that it's got to come back around because the right hemisphere and the right side, you know, the feeling part of life will not be neglected anymore. It cannot be negated or shut down anymore. And then there's a huge compensation that has to happen for that extreme of the other side. So I don't believe that it is abnormal. But I believe that it's called abnormal because we don't recognize it anymore. It's almost like a lost language that's been left in the ruins, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I totally concur that it's not abnormal. It is perfectly normal. It is what we are as human beings, but it is abnormal culturally.
In psychology, it's abnormal psychology.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I felt that effect when I started to talk about the dreams and whatnot, or, you know, sometimes it would come as a loud voice. I mean, when we got back to the apartment that night in Seattle and we prevented that fire, it was a voice that I heard. And so when I mentioned the voice, I mean, I actually had some colleagues that said, you know, Courtney, you cannot talk about this stuff. It sounds like schizophrenia. It sounds like thought projection and delusions. And I mean, I heard every kind of negative pejorative that's used in mental illness as a, you know, for me to defend myself against. And so I have felt that stigma personally of what it's like to be yourself and be open and curious and try to have conversation about these things and just be completely shut down by it because I was called mentally ill. There's no other way to put it. I mean, they put it nicely. Talking about this, you know, in like public places, but it felt horrendous. Like, how could they think I'm mentally ill? But there was no basis for it. I mean, we worked in a population of people who were chronically mentally ill and knew what that, you know, was like. So I have feeling that this book that I wrote was to be an advocate so that other folks would understand that it is normal and normalize it and try to get rid of that stigma. It's just so unhelpful. It's not helpful.
You know, my experience is tangentially related, but it's very important in that you're familiar with the Myers-Briggs?
Oh, sure.
Okay,
absolutely.
So I'm an
INFJ.
Oh, well, I'm an INTJ, so.
Okay, there you have it.
But now the T, you know, for those who don't know, that means it's kind of, you make decisions based on logic and data.
The thinking
aspect. But but in deep sort of Jungian-related Myers-Briggs talks, because I've studied Myers-Briggs quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
The shadow side, the shadow self of the INTP is the F. And the F, and the F emerges, your shadow side emerges with older age. It doesn't emerge with younger age, it emerges with older age. And as I was getting older, I have a woman who is, all my coaches are of the last several years of my personal life coaches have been female, and one of them, Taryn Voget, when I told her about one of my dreams and a couple of things that had occurred to me, said, "You have been visited by the divine feminine, and she is giving you insights into life that you never would have had through the masculine lens." I think that led me more toward this sensitive sort of thinking, compassion, empathy, truly paying much more attention. I've always been sort of empathic with people, but it's gone to a whole different level.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that, because just to quantify this for folks who might not understand the Myers-Briggs, is that we all have what Jung called superior functions. So the superior functions are pretty much like your go-to ways that you show up in the world, and the way you perceive things and the way you respond to them and how you handle stress. But the inferior functions, the ones that come on the, you know, like the tail end of your, you know, INFJ. So my inferior function is the judging, you know. One of the things that's so interesting about the intuitive part of that is that when you have intuitive as a superior function, it comes, you know, easily, and you're using it all the time. But for folks that have it as a inferior function, and they tap into that, like you're talking about the divine feminine visiting, or the, you know, the anima, and having that profound experience or insight that opened up worlds for you within yourself, that's kind of the way it is when you have a discovery through the inferior function. It comes about like a wave almost, where it hits you. And so for people who don't have the intuition as their first primary superior, but it's an inferior, when they tap into the inferior, it's amazing. It's incredibly accurate, prophetic almost.
Oh,
and
truly.
So, you know, it's so interesting that you had that awareness and you were guided to that, because it's synchronistic, right? A lot of times things that you're working on come through in synchronistic ways, and it feels intuitive, feels like an intuitive awakening or a process.
Oh, the feminine is so strong in my life now. That it just gives me perceptions of a whole different way of living. You know what I want to do is
that seeing that. I mean, I think you're, you know, a microcosmic example of that. And then when we extrapolate out of that and see what's happening globally, I think the feminine principle is demanding of our attention now. It's so important for us to respect nature. We come from nature. I mean, we're born in nature. And I think the division that we've created, and in many ways with science, is we've made everything so linear and logical that the feminine principle is demanding our attention now. And it's good to hear, you know, a man say that he's in touch with that more and more and more, because I do believe that that's evolutionarily where we need to go.
I so agree. I was going to comment on that about the feminine, that I've forgotten my comment, so I will ignore that. Tell me, let's wrap up this. We have listeners that are kind of catching what we're talking about.
Okay,
and there are listeners, I'm sure, that have felt this but not known what to do with it. I have a couple of questions for you. How can people who are interested, you know, along with reading your book, which again I say is very well written, how can they come to recognize the sensitive nature of themselves and begin to accept that and move on from that. What sort of steps are there things? What do you look for? Like, I would have never looked for the divine feminine. I needed a coach. You know, I wouldn't, even though she was appearing to me so much, I wouldn't have been able to access it because I had no context. I had no information from that.
And you don't need it. And here's why. When you are struggling with something, okay, anything, or there's a challenge, or you have a blind spot and you're not sure what's going on, the beautiful thing about everything that we just discussed is that it's a balance, right? It's a natural balance within yourself. And so as you start to seek what's going on, if you think you might be sensitive, and that starts to come up in your awareness, in your environment, that's what sensitivity is. I mean, it starts to come towards you and coalesce around you. It could be in the people that you have conversations with. It could be in situations that you're thinking about as you're listening to this conversation and they come to mind. So my first thing to tell people is to pay attention. Be aware. I mean, sensitive people are already so aware, but a lot of times because we are so aware and we perceive all that sensory information coming in, we get overwhelmed. And then we get distracted, or we're trying to flee from certain feelings that are overpowering. And so the first thing I tell people when they're trying to go through that discovery process is just to stop and listen and pay attention. Because once you start to unravel it, it becomes very clear that you're sensitive. It's the conversations you're having with other people. It's how you they make you feel as well. And when you feel sensitive, that can translate into vulnerability. So I like to tell people to first just stop and watch and observe and try to step away from the emotional part and see it more as a movie, if you can, to take out some of the sting of what sensitivity may have brought you in your life, if it was a painful experience. Because that's usually why we try to shy away from it, if it brought us any kind of pain or rejection. Or
rejection,
you know,
yeah, that's the rejection. Who's going to believe me? They're going to think
I'm
nuts.
Yeah, and who will want to be my friend or care for me or love me or be in a relationship with me if I'm, I mean, the worst is, right, I'm unlovable, right? Or I'm too difficult, or if I'm a pain in the ass. I mean, so once you start to accept that you are, if you are, really, truly sensitive, then the world opens up. And then you start to find your people and your tribe and your community. And there's a lot of sensitive people that find one another because they're starting to look. Oh. And so when you recast things with new eyes and get excited about it, it becomes a different kind of experience. And life becomes a lot less, like you said, traumatic, dramatic, and it becomes more predictable, and you find your community.
You know, and that's something we haven't talked about, and maybe we'll have to do this again, because I like your emphasis on community, that this is not a solo act.
No.
That if you must have your tribe, you must have your community, you must have, as you talked about Gandhi, whenever I'm troubled, I look for my tribe, I look for my community, I look for people to share my experience with.
Look for the helpers. Look for the helpers. Because
correct.
They arrive.
Yeah.
They arrive, and they really do.
Well, I want to tell you, Courtney Makasani, you are a very special person, and this has been a special time for me today.
Thanks, Charlie. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thanks so much for having me on. I love our conversations. They're so deep and refreshing, and you really get it. And it's so nice when you can connect with other sensitive people, too, who are on that level, because it's so enriching and juicy and lovely. So thank you for that.
I just had a conversation with another person who is very strongly into another discipline of mine, and I said, what a treasure. We had lunch yesterday. What a treasure it is to talk to somebody who understands what I'm talking about. You know, instead of me trying to explain myself and people looking at me glassy-eyed.
Yeah, don't justify. No backsliding. You don't need to justify.
No backsliding.
It's always okay just to be just who you are in the right moment. I mean, I like to tell that to people. If you make mistakes, that's one thing.
Yeah.
Apologize for your mistakes or make reparations, but don't ever apologize for who you are.
I totally agree.
Your soul. You know, show up with those things. They're important.
Well, Courtney, I'm going to put your book on the show notes. Can I put your sensitivity test on the show notes?
Yeah, sure.
Because I think that might be interesting. It's a test. It's an assessment. And Courtney will then give you the results of your assessment and how that shows, you know, where you're gifted.
And I score those individually, you know.
I saw that. You did that.
I send a note. I try to be very responsive about it because I know people want to know. They're all excited. So I try to be uber responsive.
Yeah, you're great. So I will include that in the show notes. And I just want to thank you once again. You've been a very, very special guest. And I love your topic and your book.
Thank you. Have a great night.
Okay. And I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And please be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.